I'm going to lead from where Don kind of left off and just point out maybe a couple of the, which you've probably already seen, a couple of the links. And one of them I'm going to start with is Robert Whitaker, who painstakingly did some medical journalism that won him a few awards and stuff, or at least one award or two. His book called Mad in America back in 2001, I think it was, or two, was something I came across late in my own research. I was glad I did, because all the things that I was exploring and putting together were backed up in his research. He wasn't simply showing us what maybe Reagan or before him the generation of Crane and other kind of critical psychiatrists or MDs were working on. He was also interested in memos being sent between companies and the professionals and in the associations. And so he gave us a more social side of the development of these methods of intervention. So he's an excellent resource in trying to figure out just what we're being told about medications and how those messages were developed through commerce and the authorities. So I'm gonna read a bit, since Don did such a great job of dealing with some of the effects and stuff, of kind of a précis of what his work said to me in his book. Although I do want to talk a little bit about the extension of what Don was talking about to the question of legality, which is the basis of this book. I mean, given that we know all of these things about these drugs, and we can quibble about what the percentages are of the people who go on them and who succumb to negative effects over time, how often, and so on. But really, what we're looking at is, you've got a range of risk or danger that's quite high. So, and I'll illustrate in a moment. I also want to point out that because these treatments are being imposed, legally imposed, we're not really simply looking at a kind of a bad therapeutic idea. It's not simply that we need to debate whether or not we should take the medications that are being prescribed. Really, the question for me, and I think one of your commenters, Zaz, Dr. Thomas Zaz, mentions it, it's like, we're being given this stuff based on the idea that it's therapeutic. And what kind of confuses us sometimes is what happens when it's being forced. Because the question tends to be, I think, in many people's minds, why would you have to force a medication that should work? Right? At least after it's been forced the first time. If you're continuously forcing it on someone over time, or if you're getting a court order to have it imposed on somebody for 6 months under a community treatment order, for example, or for longer, what gives? Why are we using extensively treatments that don't seem to be working? If we're just guesstimating and hoping that the first time out it works, there's a legal theorist who says that might be the way to do this, is maybe there should be one chance only. You try imposing it, and if it doesn't work, that's the end of the story. But of course, no one would accept that, because that's only one drug. You could try another drug, you could try yet another drug, you could try a combination of drugs. You could try a combination of drugs and anti-side effect medications. And so on it goes. I mean, there's many ways of disputing the therapeutic effects. And that's why I had to write this book. It's because we are not only looking at a question of therapy. We're not only looking at what works to sedate someone, bring somebody into a more clinically viable or socially acceptable way of behaving, right? Which is generally just more well-behaved. I'm going to point you to Robert Whitaker to get more in depth. So let me give you some of his history and stuff. I should point out that Reagan is a psychiatrist who believes in the biological basis of mental illness, and from a critical perspective, he does not treat physical disability with much delicacy in his texts either. However, his observations from within a clinical or therapeutic paradigm raise some of the points to be made about the usefulness of neuroleptics as restraints. There is no significant body of research to prove that neuroleptics have any specific effect on psychotic symptoms, such as hallucinations and delusions. To the contrary, these remain rather resistant to the drugs. The neuroleptics mainly suppress aggression, rebelliousness, and spontaneous activity in general. This is is why they are effective whenever they were, whenever and wherever social control is out of prudent, such as in mental hospitals, nursing homes, prisons, institutions for persons with developmental disabilities, children's facilities, and public clinics, as well as in Russian and Cuban psychiatric political prisons. Their widespread use for social control in such a wide variety of people and institutions makes the claim that they are specific for schizophrenia ridiculous. That's him writing in 1994. The development of neuroleptics and their eventual adoption by psychiatry during the mid-20th century has been well documented by Robert Whitaker, an award-winning medical journalist. He explains that those who pioneered this chemical methodology knew that brain function was not being balanced by neuroleptics, but rather grossly disrupted. As to why this might be happening, he cites a leading psychiatrist of his time, Abraham Myers, writing in a neurological journal of 1942 on the subject of brain damage and death by electroconvulsive therapy. Myers was a clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard University. He said, "I think it may be true that these people have, for the time being at any rate, more intelligence than they can handle, and that the reduction of intelligence is an important factor in the curative process. I say this without cynicism. The fact is that some of the best cures that one gets are in those individuals whom one reduces almost to amnesia." And I don't think he's talking about intelligence as in, wow, dental patients are so witty. I think he's talking about agency and the will to push, things, right? And just in terms of questions, as soon as my bit is over, we're going to take a short 5-minute break and we'll come back for a group discussion. So maybe just write out anything that strikes you. As to how this might be happening, the exact mechanism of neuroleptics was discovered by Carlson in 1963, well after they were first introduced in 1950. Using positron emission tomography scans, PET scans, Carlson found that at maintenance or therapeutic doses, neuroleptics block 70 to 90% of the brain's T2 receptors. These are a kind of dopamine receptor in some nerve endings. In Parkinson's disease, about 80% of such receptors are blocked. What neuroleptics do then, Whitaker says, is induce a pathological deficiency in dopamine transmission. They induce, in Deniker's words, another psychiatrist he's citing, quote, a therapeutic Parkinsonism. Neuroleptization results in a hindrance of dopamine pathways like the brain's necrostriatal system, which regulates movement. Whitaker considers this latter function a basic form of restraint. He says neuroleptics block a second dopamine pathway called the mesolimbic system, the seat of emotional response, which allows us to respond to the world. The limbic system, quote, remains vigilant to environmental dangers, and if danger is seen, it mounts an emotional response. By impairing the limbic system, neuroleptics blunt this arousal response, an effect that has made the drugs useful in veterinary medicine for taming animals. And then he gives us a couple of quotations. This second clamp on the brain not only destabilizes motor control, he says, it undercuts responses to the environment, rendering a person more agreeable or manageable, depending on how well she can still communicate. It should be noted that the oldest phenothiazins, this is my own note, led to the development of much stronger neuroleptics, especially haldoprazol. Whitaker, in 2010, notes that in 1991, the heroin contaminant and neurotoxin, MPTP, was found to closely resemble haldoprazol, and both were subsequently used to induce Parkinsonism in animals for medical research. In any case, this drug action leads to a disturbing disruption in the ability to know or communicate. Not only motor control and responsiveness, but also cognition is decreased. A third dopamine pathway, called the mesocortical system, is blocked, which severs communication between the frontal lobe, the seat of thinking and decision-making, and older areas of the brain. Quote, indeed, experiments with monkeys have shown that if the mesocortical dopaminergic system is impaired, the prefrontal cortex doesn't function well. Quote, he's actually quoting the Principles of Neuroscience, a modern neurology textbook. Depletion of dopamine in the prefrontal cortex impairs the performance of monkeys in cognitive tasks, similar to ablation or destroying of the prefrontal cortex. And this is where you talk about the bottom. In penological terms, targeting these three functions, movement, will, and consciousness, if only to destabilize them, results in a physiological hold, isolation, or incarceration. Goffman's definition in 1961 of incarceration only involved the regulation of the body's movement in space and communication with others socially. my own definition, relies on a reduced or depreciated internal automatic capacity for movement in any environment and communication, rather than social communication. All movement and all relationships are affected, both physically and socially. I need to mention again that by using scientific data, indeed critical examinations of psychiatric experiments, I am not suggesting that emotions and experiences are biologically based or disordered. I prefer to understand these data as describing how the body, which can be considered convergence of many conditions, is affected by chemical impositions, as well as other limitations and errors in human management of the social. I'm going to read a little bit from a more personal perspective. Because I think that we often get bogged down in the details, and we don't often talk about how to resist within, right? And that's kind of what this is all about here, this piece. Let's start from page 129, Segregation Without Walls. I've come back from Vancouver after I'd been incarcerated and drugged and arrested, and so I'm back in Toronto with my former partner at the time. Toronto is much colder than I ever remembered. I realize I am no longer the same person. I'm still saying to my family incessantly, it seems, that I need to get better and hopefully reduce my medications. It is causing me to feel nothing, I tell them. And my thinking is too slow for me to find work. I try to draw, and my concentration falls apart very quickly. I try to play guitar, but there's no tension in my fingers. And I can barely remember the chords to my own songs. I try to write, but I have nothing in me, nothing that I care about. I try to set up an action plan on finding work, but I find myself going in circles, small circles. I meet a couple of psychiatrists who are nice, but one of them is too smart with the symbols, and the other works in a hospital, and I can't stand the memory of the hospital. I see a dentist. He explains that the swelling of my gums and the lack of saliva in my mouth are a side effect that will get worse. I will have to be extra vigilant to delay the inevitable loss of my teeth. Everything means less and less, because I don't feel it long enough, if at all. Each moment is broken from the last, and without any feeling, the story ceases to impress upon me. I can speak and listen, but it's bland, empty. Any emphasis is an extra effort. When I talk, I have very little to say, and people lose interest. I read a paragraph or two and forget what I read. I'm watching this happen. My partner and my family talk about things that matter to them, that used to matter to me, but I'm not engaged at all. One day, my roommate asks to try a half dose of my amoxicillin. He is 5'10" tall, 170 pounds, a drinker, and a smoker. He returns in 1 hour saying he can't stay awake. He sleeps for 36 hours and is somewhat lost when he awakens. This is actually close to what actual psychiatrists tried in the 50s. They found the same effects, devastating effects. I walk up the street spending my daily government allotment on a falafel. I am never noticed on the street, even though I feel like the walking dead, and I avoid being noticed. Weeks pass and nothing changes, including my halting determination to get off the drugs. A psychologist friend says, "You don't have to stay on that shit, you know. They can't make you take it." It's true. Yet my hospital education says otherwise. I remember my doctor's word, relapse. I never want to relapse, to be taken back into a hospital because I stopped taking my medication and went mad. I still think weird thoughts, but they're under control. I fantasize that against the odds, I will live a somewhat normal life someday. Others are cheery about this prospect. One day, 4 months after my hospitalization, my partner walks in and says she has to leave me. I am doing my laundry, and though I hear what she's saying, I don't feel anything. I try to think back to our time together, but no image comes to mind, no conversation or event. I try to feel a connection to her, but feel nothing. My intellect is telling me this is important, but my mind tends to float to other concerns. I concern myself with the immediate task of sorting the socks. She stares at me. Sensing that she is waiting for a response, I apologize. "Sorry, I wish I knew what to say." My face shows undead calm. My partner of 2 years starts crying uncontrollably like she's never cried before. I remember to stay grounded, like the nurse said, to not stress myself. But I empathize with her. She is a stranger who has dropped a bag of vegetables. I wish there was something I could say, I repeat. It's not that I don't care. It's just that there is nothing to say. But how can I explain that? How can I tell her that I can't feel when I don't care enough to notice I can't feel? I am living in an emotional absence, aware mostly of time passing away. After she leaves, I tell my brother and his partner, and they are genuinely concerned. I tell them like I am reporting something, an event on the news, and they are the ones who feel for me. After a moment has passed, they also get nothing from my reaction. The conversation returns to the usual. My family goes to discussions in which there is emotion, even riotous emotion later in the evening. I try to join in, speaking slowly or haltingly as I try to think fast. It's not that I'm a sad figure or too crazy to make sense of. It's not that they dislike the new me. It is me, after all, and they will come to accept how I am eventually. They already have in some ways. It is that I am not there. It is that I am not about me. I'm not interested in myself. I'm still playing the object, doing the work of the mental patient, which is to stay out of trouble. My life has shrunk before my eyes. I stare with detachment at my patient self. Dishes are cleared and washed, and the television's back on. In another month, my former partner will show me a pamphlet that reads, "Proud to be Crazy." And I will go to my first meeting with a group of psychiatric survivors. With their help, I will gain the courage to ask my shrink to let me decrease the loxapine by 5 milligrams every 3 weeks. It will seem harrowing at first, as my brain starts getting environmental messages again. By August, I will have gone off all my drugs, started working, and found new friendships to last a lifetime. So this is a bit of a lucky, happy story. I'm one of the very, very few people who's escaped that system, and one of the very, 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 very few people who's gone to school afterwards and decided to write about it, which I think was not a responsibility thing, and neither was it a joy thing. Oh, great, I got to go to school and write about it. But it was something like something I had to let go of, something I had to write off. And if I hadn't done that, I think I would have just carried those memories with me forever. And I don't think that it would have been a very easy way to live, because you just kind of always think, well, you know, if anything ever happens again, if I ever become distressed and ask somebody for help again, the funnel, as Goffman described it, will bring me back to this space of, we know, but there's nothing we can do. This is the best, as one of the psychiatrists that I quoted here, the people I interviewed, this is the best that medicine has to offer right now. It's kind of like a good luck. But, you know, have a look at Whitaker, have a look at the work being done at Katie. I'm just thinking about the CATIE study that was done by Lieberman at the National Institute for Mental Health. In this study, they compared the old and the new drugs. So I think they used Halol, or maybe it was prednisone, with some of the newer stuff, like Geodon, I think, was one of them. Zyprexa, I'm not sure, three other of the drugs.
You said Zyprexa?
Yes. All right, so I just wanted to point the study out because it's one of the studies that I tell to my students, because it's very instructive. It this is the National Institute for Mental Health. This is not a psychiatric survivor organization doing the study. And what they do is they give something like 1,500 willing patients, labeled schizophrenic, they invite people into the study. They've got people in, I think it was several cities, doing this thing. So they've put a quarter of those folks on one of these four drugs. And they're really trying to show that the newer antipsychotics won't do the damage of the old ones, and that they'll be much more effective. They're looking for a scientific basis again and again and again for what it is that they're saying. And what they find, I'll ask you, what do you think they found? How many of 100, if you're looking at the full 1,500 people, 100%, how many of those folks, after 18 months, are still using their medication? Any guesses?
Zero.
Seven.
So what's the answer?
She's good. No, not 7%. It's a little higher than that. It's a little higher. I'll tell you. I thought it might be 33 in my naivete, because I think 33 is the kind of the magic placebo number. If something is ineffective, you know, it's about 30% effective, to put it. But it was actually 25%. They found that after 18 months, only 25% of those patients on any of those drugs stayed on them. And what the other 75% what they reported was that either they had to get off because the effects were simply too distressful or too ruinous, kind of disabling effects, iatrogenic impairment, or they simply didn't work. There were a few who dropped out, an insignificant number. Of the 25% that are remaining, you know, we can ask ourselves why they're still on them, right? Because I don't fully think that, you know, that they are actually safe and effective, but perhaps there are other social factors. But no, let's just say that they are safe and effective for those 25%. What we have is a pretty low rate that, you know, the National Institute for Mental Health buried after that study. We did not hear about the King study much after that. And now they are in spin control, trying to say what's the meaning of this these findings. So those are all instructive in terms of what we're looking at. The question, as Don is raising, is, well, what do we do about it? And you know, there are some ways of getting off the drugs, but often it, you know, as there's a study in Norway right now, often it really comes down to community stuff. I mean, if you look at the Open Doors project in northwestern, I think it's called Lapland in Norway, or is it Finland? What they've done there is they've tried a study where they've brought together the community, a small community of some few thousand people. So we're not talking about an industrial urban center, but in a much closer group. They wanted to get people to talk about, you know, still a very therapeutic kind of model of thinking, symptoms of schizophrenia or psychosis. However, I think the conversations were not so medical model. I believe that the discussions were much more social, because what they've managed to do is get the whole community to understand this not as a process simply of disorder or dysfunction or problem or of deficit, but rather as a way of understanding each other, to see this as an opportunity for communicating. Right? In other words, to see the person who's exhibiting any kinds of strange behaviors or thoughts as simply trying to work through whatever it is that they're trying to work through. Let's call it distress. I tend to call it distress because it's the most general way of talking about this stuff. So by working through distress, by working through distress through these sort of supposed symptoms of seeing things, hearing things, rarely do people actually see things, mostly they hear voices, and often they might attribute to these phenomena some kind of what's called delusion, or some kind of explanation that isn't accepted by others, obviously. But when this project was underway, people were actually trying to look at these ways of being as part and parcel of the human experience. They're not looking at these experiences somehow as off the margins of human experience, way over there in what we would call something like breaking a knee or something like having a cold, right? Because even if these are something like that, where our bodies are excited into situations that they can't control themselves or whatever, in a society that wants strict control, even if they are, people get through them not by simply fixing a physical issue, as we've seen, but rather, it's quite clear from Soteria and other studies, through social interaction. That's the one way people have found that people regain not just their social standing, but also their sense of inner equilibrium and a sense of somehow having agency. Right? So I'm just opening up those possible alternatives, and we can actually talk about those or anything else after the break. I didn't get to tell you more about the sort of legal side to this stuff. So I'll just mention that again, the community treatment order imposes these kinds of medications thinking that they're safe and effective, there's no problem with it, everything's a go, we're all good here, everything, you know. And the question is, well, when these drugs are being imposed on the person, what actually happens, right? And what is the purpose? If the purpose is not simply to, you know, stabilize the patient, i.e. chemically restrain the patient for extended periods of time, right? What is the purpose? Well, of course, they're doing that in order to deliver a kind of a treatment or a therapy. But given that that therapy and treatment has very, very well-known problems, the restraint itself becomes not a treatment, but simply a holding.